Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's good to get some notebook paper and a pen so you can take notes during the show. We look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. To start off the show, this week I'm going to be looking at an article by Shahien Nasiripour from the Huffington Post. The article is called "Elizabeth Warren Helped Shoot Down Bill That Would Have Sped Foreclosures, Calendar Shows." Elizabeth Warren was the first senior Obama administration official to recognize the potentially incendiary impact of a bill that would have made it significantly easier for mortgage companies to foreclose on homes, and her subsequent warnings played a crucial role in persuading the president to veto the measure, according to freshly released documents and people familiar with the deliberations. The disclosure that Warren was instrumental in halting a bill that would have streamlined the foreclosure process comes as she confronts fierce criticism from Republicans on Capitol Hill for the way she was appointed to construct a new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and characterizations that she is inclined to take an overly punitive tack with Wall Street. A longtime advocate for greater regulation of the financial system and a prominent critic of predatory lending, Warren now finds herself at the center of an intensifying debate over the relationship between the Obama administration and the business world. For consumer advocates who have long decried what they portray as Wall Street's outsized influence in Washington, Warren represents their greatest hope that big banks will be more tightly supervised following the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. For a vocal group of business leaders and their Republican allies, Warren has become Exhibit A in their case that the Obama administration is anti-business. The decisive way in which she labored behind the scenes to stymie a bill that would have eased requirements for documentation in the foreclosure process underscores how her arrival has altered the administration's relationship with major banks. The bill, which passed both houses of Congress and awaited President Obama's signature to become law, essentially would have compelled notaries to accept out-of-state notarizations regardless of the rules in those states. State officials across the country who have been pursuing probes looking into wrongdoing within the foreclosure process feared that those jurisdictions with lax standards could have become hotbeds for foreclosure documentation fraud. Lenders and mortgage companies could have used those states as central clearinghouses to produce bogus foreclosure paperwork and then export those documents to other states with more stringent regulations, an expedient bypass around the strictures. Obama ultimately declined to sign the law, and the House of Representatives failed to override the veto. Officials said Warren was among the first officials to recognize the significance of the notary bill, titled the Interstate Recognition of Notarizations Act of 2010. She met with authorities from several states and then relayed their concerns to influential administration officials. During the morning of October 6th, Warren's team at the Treasury Department wrote the first memos on the bill, raising questions about the possible consequences if it became a law. That evening, Warren met for 30 minutes with Peter Rouse, Obama's interim chief of staff, her calendar shows. She later spent an hour on the phone with Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan, who once sued Countrywide Financial and exacted an $8.4 billion multi-state settlement. The next day, Warren participated in an afternoon meeting on the bill, her calendar shows. During the meeting, one of Obama's top spokesmen, Peter Pfeiffer, posted an entry on the White House blog explaining why Obama would not sign the bill. On October 8th, Obama declined to sign the bill into law, citing the need for further deliberations about the possible unintended impact of the bill on consumer protections, including those for mortgages. Documents released showed that Warren met or spoke with at least 8 state officials, leading a 50-state investigation into possibly fraudulent mortgage documentation practices. The state attorneys general, secretaries of state, and bank supervisors are probing the way in which major mortgage companies have pushed through thousands of foreclosure cases at a time, as if on a factory assembly line, by shortcutting the required documentation process. Recent weeks have featured a host of unsavory disclosures about how mortgage companies employed so-called robo-signers, people whose sole job was to sign foreclosure documents without reading them or confirming basic facts as required by law. The volume of cases and shoddy handling of paperwork is reflective of the messy and indiscriminate lending practices that characterized the nation's housing boom as Wall Street eagerly handed mortgage to seemingly anyone willing to sign off. The state's investigation and a parallel multi-agency federal probe are now roiling the mortgage industry, heightening the possibility that major lenders could face potentially huge fresh losses as bad loans continue to emerge. With legal and regulatory uncertainty now enshrouding the industry and public outrage trained on foreclosures, the banks could have trouble limiting those losses by selling off the homes pledged against bad mortgages. The nation's biggest lender, Bank of America, has seen its share price drop 18% through the market last week as the states announced their joint inquiry. Warren serves as an assistant to Obama and a special advisor to Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner as she leads the effort to create the new Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection, a watchdog designed to protect borrowers from abusive lenders. Her calendar was released per a Freedom of Information Act request. The longtime Harvard Law School professor and consumer advocate met or spoke with the state attorneys general from Iowa, Illinois, Texas, North Carolina, Massachusetts, and Ohio, her calendar shows. She also met with Ohio Secretary of State Jennifer Bruner and spoke with New York's top banking regulator, Richard Nyman. They are among the leaders of the combined state probe. Warren has long chided federal regulators for their lax oversight of the financial industry and slipshod protection of consumers. She's championed state regulators, however, who have often been ahead of their federal counterparts when it comes to consumer finance issues. Warren's calendar also shows numerous meetings with bankers and their representatives. Financial executives and lobbyists have noted that Warren was reaching out to them more than they initially expected. The calendar confirms her outreach. On September 20th, the same day she took a photo for her Treasury Department badge, Warren spent an hour and a half meeting with bankers from Oklahoma, her calendar shows. She spent an hour having lunch with Geithner that day as well. Since then, she's met with the chief executives of the nation's largest banks, including Vikram Pundit of Citigroup, Jamie Dimon of JPMorgan Chase, John Stumpf of Wells Fargo, James Gorman of Morgan Stanley, Richard Davis of U.S. Bancorp, W. Edmund Clark of TD Bank Financial Group, David Nelms of Discover Financial Services, Neal Booker of HSBC North America Holdings, and Kenneth Chenault of American Express. The calendar entry for Chenault's one-hour meeting on October 13th notes that he's flying here for us. Warren also met with officials from Goldman Sachs and Deutsche Bank, Germany's biggest lender and one of the world's biggest financial institutions. Notably absent from Warren's calendar are officials from Bank of America, the biggest bank in the U.S., by assets and branches, including its chief executive, Brian Moynihan. Warren's calendar includes meetings with investors and trade groups like the Consumer Bankers Association, the Independent Community Bankers of America, the Financial Services Roundtable, and the Securities, Industry, and Financial Markets Association. Warren's 2007 journal article calling for the creation of a dedicated consumer agency inspired policymakers to enact it into law. Big banks opposed it. Warren has also met with nearly two dozen members of Congress from both sides of the aisle, including the likely incoming chair of the House Financial Services Committee, Representative Spencer Baucus, and the top Republican on the Senate Banking Committee, Richard Shelby. The Alabama Republicans have been particularly critical of Warren and her new agency. Warren's calendar features numerous White House meetings, like a two-hour dinner with top Obama advisor David Axelrod and breakfasts and lunches with other top Obama counselor Valerie Jarrett. She's also met with the heads of all the major federal financial regulatory agencies, including Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke. Among Warren's early initiatives are efforts to make credit card disclosure forms shorter and easier to read, and simplifying mortgage documents. Her first major speech since joining the administration was a September 29th address to the Financial Services Roundtable, a Washington trade group representing firms like JPMorgan Chase, BlackRock, and State Farm. She asked the assembled executives to work with her to create a new system of consumer regulation focused on core principles rather than a mountain of specific rules. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now I'd like to continue with my discussion on Debtor's Hell, which is a series of articles that was written for the Boston Globe about debt collection practices and debt collectors in particular. This week we'll be talking about checkered pasts, which we started last week looking behind the badge of the constables in Massachusetts who are doing debt collection. Dalton, who owns the South Coast Legal Services constable business, changed careers in 2001 after 16 years as a Plymouth County deputy sheriff. But he didn't go willingly. He and two other cashiered deputies filed a federal lawsuit claiming they had been unjustly fired. At the trial, the county introduced evidence from a state police investigation in 2000 that Dalton had allegedly sought cash payments from a Brockton moving company trying to obtain county work in court-ordered eviction cases. The federal jury upheld the dismissals. In an interview, the 60-year-old Dalton said the allegations were false, but refused to discuss the issue further. There was never a criminal charge in the case. As for the $625 fee he charges for each car seizure, Dalton was hardly defensive about his price. He said he is considering an increase to offset the higher cost of gasoline. "I have a lot of guys burning up gas looking for cars," he said. State law requires cities and towns to investigate the reputation and character of all constable applicants, as well as their fitness for office. But the law sets no specific criteria. In some communities, a police criminal background check is required. But in some cases, the background checks appear to be cursory. In Boston, police do background checks before constables are appointed. But Dorsey, the constable who demanded $1,250 for seizing Fitzpatrick's car, was appointed even though he listed his criminal record on his application. On Super Bowl Sunday in 1994, according to court records, Boston police raided the Old Stag Tavern in Jamaica Plain, which Dorsey managed, arrested Dorsey for running a betting operation, and confiscated the two firearms. He was found guilty of a misdemeanor for possessing gaming materials and was fined $300. Dorsey, who is 50, also had a prior arrest for failure to make child support payments. Boston Police Sergeant Raymond Mosher, who oversees criminal background checks for prospective constables, said he could not discuss Dorsey's case because of privacy restrictions. Like Sorensen, both Dalton and Dorsey have had financial struggles not unlike those of some of the debtors whose cars they seize. A decade ago, Dalton had one small claims judgment and two federal tax liens against him, according to court records reviewed by the Globe. And Dorsey says his own struggles help him empathize with the people who are his quarry. To be honest, he said, I've hid from bill collectors myself. But now let's go over to sheriffs. Unlike constables, for whom no one sets standards, Massachusetts county sheriffs have to face the voters every 6 years. That can work as a check on overzealous collection work. We do not want people saying, the elected sheriff took my car and then junked it, said Jeffrey Turco, the chief deputy to Worcester. After receiving inquiries from the Globe, the Massachusetts Sheriff's Association is reviewing the fees they charge hooking cars for debt collectors. No sheriff's department has seized more autos than Worcester County's, more than 1,000 since January of 2002. And for GLOTUS, who took office in 2005, some of those seizures could prove to be politically embarrassing. Take the case of Marlene Cote, who last December filed for bankruptcy, a step that legally protects assets from seizure. Or so Cote thought, until the evening of January 13th, when two of GLOTUS' deputy sheriffs banged on her door at 8:30 p.m. and said they were seizing her 11-year-old Jeep. By Cote's account, the deputies were undeterred when she showed them her bankruptcy filing. They even threatened to arrest her when she stood between the tow truck and her vehicle. Cote's debt, an old $300 bill from a local dentist, barely topped $600 with accumulated interest. The fee charged by the deputies added another $600, and the towing company wanted $310. The total, for a car that could not legally be seized, was $1,530. When the Globe first raised Cote's case with Deputy Turco, he acknowledged that the deputy sheriffs should have checked with his office when they were presented with the bankruptcy documents. According to his office records, Cote's car was returned within a few days when the error was discovered. In fact, however, the car was still being held 2 months after it was towed away by DiRenzo Towing and Recovery, which had added another $1,200 in storage fees in the interim. Finally, at the end of March, Cote's car was returned and all the charges were waived. But Cote paid dearly for the episode as she struggled to regain her financial footing. During the 10 weeks she had to get by without her Jeep, Cote said, she spent between $600 and $800 to commute by taxi to her $8 an hour job as a cashier at Kohl's department store. During that period, she also had to abandon a second job, caring for mental health patients in group homes. It felt to her, as to many who lose their cars to unpaid debts, like a prison term for a traffic offense, and such penalties are far from rare. A review of Worcester Sheriff's official records released by Turco showed numerous instances of debt collectors engaging deputy sheriffs to seize cars from people with small unpaid debts. Often, the fees associated with seizure doubled or even tripled the amount of the original debt. Collection lawyer Richard Hubbard is the source of many of those cases. He has had hundreds of cars hauled away, mostly by the Worcester County Sheriff's Department, from families whose unpaid or disputed debts to dentists, doctors, and local heating oil companies were just a few hundred dollars. For its part, the Worcester Sheriff's Department has made one change in the wake of Globe inquiries. They had been charging $600 for all car seizures, whether the car is towed or the debtor pays the amount owed on the spot. Now, those who pay their debts to avoid a tow are charged $300. In some other jurisdictions, sheriffs and constables have gone even further. In fact, most decline to seize autos. And the vast majority of debt collectors, likewise, frown on the practice. In Suffolk and Barnstable counties, for example, the sheriff's departments rarely seize automobiles. And in the few instances when Barnstable deputies seize a car, they charge just $40 an hour for a deputy's time, according to Barnstable Chief Deputy Sheriff Brad Parker. When asked about constables who charge between $600 and $900 to seize a car, Parker said, "That's gouging." As for his peers in other sheriff departments who charge up to $600, Parker chose his words carefully. "That sounds high." Parker said his office was approached 2 years ago by Norfolk Financial Corp. and Commonwealth Receivables, Inc., two collection agencies that have seized thousands of cars, and asked to do their seizure work on Cape Cod, but he refused. Too often, Parker said, such cases are against a single mother with kids and a beat-up old car and no other transportation. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now, in debtor's hell, let's move on to regulators, policymakers, seldom intervening. The debt business, as Donald Friedman, the chief operating officer of debt buyer Liberty Point Corp., told hundreds of his assembled peers at their gathering, is one of the sexiest, one of the most financially lucrative businesses you can get into. Boastful? Yes. Overstated? Hardly. Let's take, for instance, 2005. That year, businesses that specialized in debt for collection purchased $66 billion in delinquent bank credit card accounts alone, paying just pennies on the dollar for the right to press consumers to pay up. That $66 billion represented a golden opportunity for them and sudden vulnerability for an estimated 8 million cardholders, all of them earmarked for repeated phone calls, Dunning letters, lawsuits, wage garnishments, property seizure, and sometimes even arrest. They generally owed the money, but seldom anticipated the consequences. A Globe investigation team found a system where debt collectors have a lopsided advantage, where debtors frequently face high-handed treatment, and where excessive fees can swiftly turn a small delinquency into a life-upending financial crisis. Yet, in spite of all this, there is an eerie silence among regulators, policymakers, and legislators. Those who could intervene to right the balance between collectors and consumers are either unaware of the debt collection free-for-all and the tens of millions of consumers caught up in it, or they are simply unwilling to act. In Massachusetts, for example, almost 800 complaints about debt collectors flow each year into the office of Attorney General Thomas Riley, whose state website declares that he is on the front line working for consumers. Yet, since Riley took office in 1999, he has initiated legal action against just one collection agency, a Danvers company that paid a $100,000 fine several years ago. When Riley's office announced that settlement with Schreiber & Associates, it called it just the start. This investigation is part of a larger initiative aimed at protecting consumers from unfair debt collecting practices. Now, that was several years ago. Since then, no legal actions have been announced, though a spokesman for Riley said that five investigations of debt collections are underway. Similarly passive is the Massachusetts Division of Banks, which also has regulatory authority over collectors. The bank regulators do little more than warehouse required annual filings by 410 debt collection companies haphazardly, as the Globe discovered when it sought access to the division's records. Meanwhile, the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, which is charged with enforcing a federal law that regulates the behavior of debt collectors, has done little in the face of an explosion of consumer outrage. For example, from 1998 to 2005, the number of consumer complaints about debt collectors soared tenfold, from 6,600 to 66,000 complaints. Yet, in the last 10 years, the FTC has taken enforcement action against just 10 companies. An estimated 20 million Americans are 3 months or more past due on credit card accounts alone, According to data given to the Globe by Experian, one of the three national credit reporting agencies. Yet it appears no one in government is keeping track of this alarming trend, not even the Federal Reserve Board, which assures Congress that bank credit card delinquency rates are not high by historical standards. Omitted from that calculation are the tens of billions of dollars that are written off the books by the credit card giants and sold to debt buyers for collection. Court administrators, who are most likely to be aware of the tidal wave of lawsuits against debtors, have not, for the most part, raised concerns about credit caseloads that have turned many courtrooms into de facto subsidiaries of the collection business. Meanwhile, Congress and many state legislatures have acquiesced to the politically powerful banking industry, which issues much of the credit that goes sour. The laws regulating debt collection predate by a generation the current boom for debt collectors. Their ranks have doubled in the last decade. Frustrated regulators say the result is that many of the roughhouse tactics employed by collectors are legal. Jesse Kaplan, the chief of Riley's Consumer Protection and Antitrust Division, said the vast bulk of complaints to his office about debt collectors are not actionable, but amount to a misunderstanding of what consumer laws protect against. Kaplan said his office informs consumers of their rights and sometimes mediates disputes between consumers and debt collectors. That would come as a surprise to Roberta Anderson of Massachusetts. She felt she had nowhere to turn but the Attorney General after a debt collector sued her in 2003 for credit card debt she says she had long since settled. Riley's office, she said, seemed uninterested in her complaint. They said they couldn't do anything for me and told me to post a complaint on the internet, Anderson said. At the Division of Banks, the authority to audit debt collection firms is infrequently used because the law doesn't require it. We're not under any statutory requirement to examine debt collectors, David Cotney, Chief Operating Officer for the Division of Banks, said. And at the Federal Trade Commission, the senior enforcement official acknowledged that the agency has not kept pace with consumer complaints, even though debt collection generates far more complaints than any other activity in the marketplace. Clearly, the trend is not good, and we're quite concerned about that, said Peggy Tuig, the associate director of the Federal Trade Commission's Division of Financial Practices. Tuig said her agency is planning to increase its enforcement of federal debt collection laws. Asked about the tenfold increase in complaints and the tiny number of FTC enforcement actions, Tuig replied, "It's a fair point. The record is what it is." This kind of government inaction has left millions of people feeling they have nowhere to turn and no one on their side when debt collectors come calling. Manuela Cormier is one among the millions, waiting with 100 other forlorn debtors in a three-hour queue at the New Bedford District Court. Cormier stood convicted of misfortune. 5 years ago, the 45-year-old single mother lost her job and had no money to make payments on a $1,000 credit card bill. The combination of 29% interest rate, penalty fees, and court-imposed costs have since pushed the bill close to $4,000. Cormier was told she would be jailed if she did not pay. She agreed to pay $25 a month from her $10.25 an hour salary as a home health aide, not even enough to cover the $38 monthly interest on the debt. "I'll be paying until the day I die," Cormier lamented. "And I will continue this saga next week." This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.